The Nation of Islamic Cooperation condemns the storming of Al-Aqsa Mosque by Israeli settlers backed by troops, calling on the international community to hold Israel accountable. Well, welcome to our studios in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Iran's president is in New York to attend the 78th session of the UN General Assembly. Speaking to U.S. Media Corps, Ebrahim Raisi described the recent prisoner swap deal between Iran and the U.S. as a humanitarian measure. Raisi said any steps that Washington takes toward fulfilling his commitment helps build confidence. Raisi also touched upon several other issues. He stressed that the Iranian nation will not succumb to sanctions, and even American officials admit that the so-called maximum pressure campaign against Tehran has failed. Elsewhere in his remarks, the Iranian president reiterated that U.S. presence in West Asia will never create security there. Raisi also noted that the promotion of ties with neighboring countries is one of his administration's key policies. But he said the interference of foreigners, including the U.S., has damaged some relations among regional countries. Toyed Asadi is an academic and political analyst who joins us. Toyed Asadi, welcome to the program. When you take a look at this prisoner swap that has taken place, what's very interesting is the way that the Western media is portraying this in a one-sided lens, that Iran is the one that was at fault illegally detaining the prisoners that it did, and that the U.S. was okay. But nobody talks about the Iranians that were held by the U.S. And the fact that they were held based on what stems on many of these cases when it comes to Iran, the illegal U.S. sanctions, whereas the charges that Iran has leveled against the prisoners, which it has evidence of, were spying charges which threatened national security of Iran. Why do you think that narrative is not being played out so that both sides of the coin, in a matter of speaking, can be at least viewed?
Well, first of all, thank you very much for having me. And then secondly, I think the fact that we see such kind of bias in the Western media is something not very uncommon. We have been constantly observing this kind of misrepresentation of realities in order for giving a very negative picture out of Iran. But the truth of the matter is that if we take a look at the fact on the ground, we will easily understand. First, we're talking about the money that is going to be paid to Iran. When you take a look at Western media, and they cite sometimes some Republican congressmen, they say that U.S. has been forced to be blackmailed, and this is a kind of ransom. But the truth of the matter is that this is a money that has been legally belonging to Iran and has been illegally frozen by the United States. So this is not like they're paying something for return of their prisoners inside Iran. A and B, the fact is that these people have been have gone through the trajectory of a legal procedure inside the country, the result of which is that they have faced claims and they have been convicted, so everything is quite natural and ordinary. But the fact that the Americans are following an exceptionalist vantage point results in such kinds of misrepresentations in their behavior. I think all in all, we can say that what has been taking place is certainly one step forward. First of all, because of the fact that this is one of the first times that Iran is receiving something tangible and immediate out of the trajectory of talks, either direct or indirect, with the United States. And then a second point is that if the two sides can untangle the knots one by one, separately, issue by issue, and only if the United States decides to practice a pragmatic, realistic foreign policy approach pertaining to Iran, then it would be easier to anticipate the solution of problems in the ties between the two countries. Otherwise, if Washington decides to continue the same trajectory of rancorous, hostile approach towards Iran, the issues, of course, the remaining issues are going to be hard to be solved.
Okay, thank you for that. Tony Dasadi, academic and political analyst. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
South Korea confirms the transfer of unfrozen Iranian assets to a third country. The assets have been blocked in South Korea due to U.S. anti-Iran sanctions.
The Iranian funds that had been frozen in South Korea due to financial sanctions on Iran have been recently transferred to a third country successfully under close coordination among the involved countries. Our government expects the South Korea-Iran relations to further develop on the occasion of the transfer of the frozen funds. All of the detailed matters on the transfer of the frozen funds were decided based on the agreements between relevant nations, including Iran.
South Korea's confirmation comes one day after the Iranian Foreign Ministry announced that some $6 billion of Iranian assets are under the control of Iran's central bank. The ministry added that the funds will be spent based on Iran's needs and priorities. It also denounced as illegal and inhumane Washington's measures to prevent Iran from having access to its financial resources in other countries. The Iranian funds had remained blocked in two South Korean banks since the year 2018. Azerbaijan says it has started a military operation in Nagorno-Karabakh, a region that has been the source of a bitter dispute with neighboring Armenia for decades. The Azeri Defense Ministry says it is using high-precision weapons on the front line and in depth as part of the operation. The move comes hours after Baku reported two separate mine blasts in Karabakh that left six people, including Azerbaijan's interior ministry staff, dead. Baku has blamed the blasts on what are called illegal Armenian armed groups. The Azeri Defense Ministry says humanitarian corridors have been established to evacuate Karabakh civilians. Azerbaijan says it has informed Russia and Turkey about its operation. Moscow says it is in contact with Baku. The Nagorno-Karabakh region is populated mainly by Armenians, but it is an internationally recognized part of Azerbaijan. The two countries have fought several wars over the region. Azerbaijan recaptured large parts of land in and around it in the 2020 war. Iraq has vowed that it will not allow any threat from its Kurdistan region to Iran based on the security agreements between the two countries. The Iraqi Foreign Minister Fuad Hussein made the pledge during a meeting with his Iranian counterpart Hossein Amir Abdullahian. The meeting was held on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly in New York. The two neighbors have reached an agreement to disarm and to relocate anti-Iran terrorist groups operating in Kurdistan region, northern Iraq. Baghdad says Kurdish armed groups along the border with Iran have handed over their heavy weaponry before the deadline for the deal, which is September 19. Iraq says the groups will be relocated to five camps in Kurdistan, but far away from Iran's border. Iran has said that it won't extend the deadline. Julia Kassam is a journalist and political analyst who joins us from Beirut. Welcome to the program. You know, when you take a look at this agreement, it's a pretty, an achievement for both sides, because you have Iran that obviously said, they're not messing around, they're going to be steadfast in terms of the deadline they have set, and then for Iraq to actually accommodate Iran with a relocation, which I'm guessing would be a complicated process. What are your initial thoughts on it?
Yeah, so Iraq also has had issues with separatist groups, Kurdish separatist groups in its borders and territory as well. As we've seen since the U.S. and Western-backed onslaught against Iran that started under the pretext of Mahsa Amini's passing in police custody, as we know, which she had the spontaneous heart attack on her own. CCPT footage shows that she did not get assaulted by the police, as the Western narrative to conjure the manufactured consent for this, for separatist terror against Iran and an onslaught against security tried to have us believe. Since then, it was a big increase in terror groups against terror groups working against Iran, provoking its borders, bringing in weapons into the country during the during the riots that targeted, like I said, Iran's security and in harmony with the U.S. sanctions that were placed against Iran and specifically its security apparatus. You know, both Iran and Iraq have had to deal with the impacts and the onslaught of separatist terror, particularly in Kurdistan, backed by the U.S. and the Zionist entity. So it is a deal, it is an agreement that benefits both nations.
When we take a look at the future here, how is the Iraqi Kurdistan going to prevent the formation of these groups from happening again? I mean, from what we understand, there also is the Israeli factor in all of this, of which even last year I'm looking at an interview that was held with the spokesperson of the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan. And basically, this person said there is, among others, an Israeli Mossad presence. I mean, these kinds of things, obviously, Iran cannot and will not tolerate. Actually, it bombed that area. This is back a few years back.
Yeah.
Do you think that this is going to be stopped by the Iraqi Kurdistan?
Well, it depends. Like many people in Iraqi Kurdistan, I'd say the overwhelming majority, have the same objectives, want to see the same things as the Iranians in stabilizing their territory, preventing Mossad provocation inside their borders, using their countries as like a launching base for attacks, their territories. So I think that there's much more mutually beneficial aspects to this than there are differences. It's just that with the level of Mossad infiltration in some elements of the Kurdistani leadership has been the provocative factor for the attacks against Iran, the instability within Kurdistan too. But it's definitely the case that there will be this current and this tide that will try to prioritize that stability and root out those provocative fifth columnist elements within Iraqi Kurdistan. Iraq not only did Iran retaliate against those attacks against the Mossad-backed elements of leadership and their military bases a few years ago, but also we saw that again happening right after the armed terroristic riots in Iran beginning in September 2022. And again, Iran has warned that if its agreements are not respected, if this deadline for disarming the border and not continuing these provocations against Iran continues, that it will do it again. It will attack again, and it has every right to do so. This deadline was announced months and months ago, at least half a year ago, possibly even longer. So the agreements are clear, and also the inclination towards internal stability and sovereignty is clear enough. And of course, the majority of those within Kurdistan want to see it as well.
Thank you for that, Julia.
They do not want to see their territory, their country, being used as a Mossad, U.S. Launching pad and base. So I trust that hopefully that could be the inclination going forth.
Thank you so much. Julia Qassam, journalist and political analyst there from Beirut. Thank you. The Organization of Islamic Cooperation has condemned Israeli settlers' incursions into the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound under the protection of the regime forces. The OIC said that Israeli incursions into Al-Aqsa almost on a daily basis are a clear violation of the Geneva Convention and international law. The organization also called on the international community to hold Israel accountable and to put an end to the regime atrocities across the occupied territories. On Sunday, Israeli settlers, backed by troops, stormed Al-Aqsa once again, provoking Palestinian anger. The Palestinian resistance groups say that Al-Aqsa Mosque is their red line, and that any aggression against it will face a strong response. And that does it for this additional world news. It's bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Face to face. Hello and welcome to Face to Face. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Today we will be speaking to another individual who has a very, very special story. I think that definitely you will be interested in the story of Mr. Kazem Darabi. So stay with us and we'll be right back.
On September 17, 1992, in Berlin, an event took place that would forever change the life of Kazem Darabi and his family. At a restaurant called Mykonos, four people were shot and killed and another wounded. All of them were leaders of the Democratic Kurdish Movement of Iran. Darabi was a businessman who was studying at the university during that time. On that day, he would be a long way from Berlin, but because of a complex plan by anti-Iranian revolutionaries, Darabi would be blamed for this attack. But why? What was the goal of this, and how has this affected he and his family?
Well, thanks so much for being with us today. We have the special guest with me. I'm glad to welcome to the program Mr. Kazem Darabi. Thanks so much for being with us here.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Darabi, you have a very interesting story, unbelievable in so many ways when we think about it. Let's start off from the beginning. Can you tell me about when you were arrested?
In 1992, I was at my residential home in Berlin, accompanied by my spouse and children, when German police raided our house, arrested me, and took me away. The next morning, I was handed a detention order, which stated that I was a member of the Revolutionary Guards, Ministry of Intelligence, of Hezbollah in Lebanon, as well as a member of the Union of Islamic Association of Students in Europe. Despite the lack of any investigations conducted into me, they arrested me and threw me into prison.
Why do you think you were arrested, though? And tell me, what were the charges at the end?
I was actively involved in religious and spiritual activities in Germany. Having resided in Berlin, Germany for about 13 years before my arrest, I was a student, and I also engaged in business activities during my studies. Furthermore, we had cultural and religious activities with Lebanese, Palestinian, Turkish, Afghan, and Muslim centers from various places. For example, we organized processions on various occasions, such as Quds Day. We also held ceremonies for the anniversary of Imam Khomeini's demise, or the 22nd of Bahman. I was very active in all of these areas and gained recognition among Muslims as well as the German police. It seems that because they did not suspect anyone else and the main culprits had fled, they arrested me simply because I was Iranian. A court was formed, and I will explain the court proceedings to you later.
Well, let's talk about your imprisonment in general. And what was it like to be in solitary confinement?
When I was arrested and the detention order was issued, I was transferred to a temporary prison in Berlin. From the beginning of my arrest, I was thrown into solitary confinement. The cell was approximately 4 square meters, and I spent 5 years in solitary confinement. However, every few months, they would transfer me to a different cell. For example, if I was in Ward B, cell 256, and they would collect my belongings and move me to another cell. This had a significant psychological impact on me and caused distress. They transferred me to different cells about 20 times. The last time, I resisted fiercely and did not allow them to change my cell. this constant shifting had a heavy mental toll on me.
Who were the witnesses that they brought in to testify against you?
After about a year of being in solitary confinement, my trial began. Approximately 275 sessions were held to address this case, and during this time, 175 witnesses appeared. All of these witnesses were individuals who had witnessed nothing about me and had heard nothing. They were all opponents and critics of the Islamic Republic of Iran, including monarchists, mujahideen, Tudeh party members, Kumilas, Democrats, and all opponents of the Islamic Republic who lived abroad and wanted to exert pressure on the system and inflict harm. They would come and give testimony, and the most significant witness in these trials was Mr. Banisadr. They brought Abul Hassan Banisadr from France to Berlin, and in court, he explained that the Islamic Republic would assassinate its opposition abroad. However, he had no logical reason and presented no evidence to support his claims. Whenever my lawyer asked him a question, he would say, "Considering that if I speak, it is possible that they will realize where I obtained the information from, and it may pose a danger to other individuals." He used this as an excuse and provided no further information or credible documents. In Germany, they claim to be a rule of law, and they cannot convict anyone without evidence and documents. However, they did this in my case. They accepted all the false claims of Iranian opposition members living outside the country.
Let's talk about Yusuf Amin and who is he and the role that he played in your sentencing.
One of the reasons that led to my arrest was a personal confession made by a person named Yusuf Amin. Yusuf Amin was an individual who had confessed to being involved in that operation. As he had stated, he had been ordered to stand at the door of the restaurant while two individuals entered and one of them opened fire on the people inside and the other administered the coup de grace to them with a pistol. This was the entirety of Yusuf Amin's confession. Regarding myself, the only thing Yusuf Amin had said was that we used to live in Kazem Darabi's house before the operation, whereas I had left that house with my family 3 years prior and moved to another home, where I was not residing at all. After he confessed to this operation, I was arrested on October 8, 1992, based on his confession, and considering that they had linked me to various organizations in Iran, a sentence was issued against me. Prior to the start of the trial, Yusuf Amin wrote a letter to the chief judge, which still exists. In that letter, he wrote, "All the statements I made were false, and the police pressured me and said that if you don't speak, we won't release your brother, who was imprisoned at that time. They coerced me and gave me many promises that if you testify, we will set you free. And now, since they did not honor their promises, I confess here that I lied to the police. And all my statements, especially regarding Kazem Darabi, were false." Because he had mentioned that he knew Kazem Darabi, who was a religious man and the leader of Muslim guys, Yusuf Amin added that because Kazem Darabi was religious, he talked about him. Furthermore, since the police wanted a lot of information about him, I gave them information and exaggerated the details because I felt that's what the police wanted. So I also lied. This is the content of a letter that Yusuf Amin had written to the judge 1 year before my trial even began. This letter was also read aloud in court. After the trial began, the first person who said, "I want to speak," was Yusuf Amin. And he clearly stated in the presence of reporters and the whole world that all the information he had given to the interrogators was wrong, and that he had lied, especially regarding Kazem Darabi. However, despite all this, Yusuf Amin's testimony in court was not accepted, and they said that the initial statement he had made was correct. For this reason, the officers who had sessions with Yusuf Amin and questioned him had to say in the presence of everyone that he lied. But they brought those officers to court, and those officers repeated his initial false statement. And in fact, they accepted the statements of the officers who had heard his private conversations. However, they did not accept the statements he made in court in front of everyone.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Well, who do you think wanted to use this situation, Mykonos situation, for their own benefit?
When the trial started, I realized that the lawyers of those who were against the Islamic Republic establishment and even the witnesses didn't care at all whether I or the other defendants would be convicted. Their only concern was to put pressure on Iran. For this reason, all the witnesses they had chosen were people against the Islamic Republic, meaning it was impossible for these individuals to speak in favor of the system. They used any means and any evidence they had, but none of them were credible. My lawyer told the chief judge that if we were allowed to have a camera there and document that kind of trial and interrogation, it would never yield positive results because the trial is entirely political. And different individuals, including even Germany and others, wanted to take advantage of the situation. Because they had individuals who were detained in Iran and had a death sentence, and they wanted to trade with them.
How did they want to incriminate the Islamic Republic in all of this?
Those who sought to exploit the court proceedings were individuals like Bani Sadr and Manoucher Ganji, who was the last minister of science during the time of the Shah, who had been invited as a witness. In other words, they had invited anyone opposing the Islamic Republic of Iran from all corners of the world and wanted to take advantage of this situation to undermine the system.
Was there any credible evidence given in the court at all?
In fact, they had no valid evidence. Even when they asked Bani Sadr where he obtained his information from, he said, "I cannot provide any document, nor can I disclose the source of this information."
Now, they had talked about the social and religious nature of your activities in Germany. You just talked about that. How did they want to connect that to the operation itself?
My religious activities were such that while I was a student, I also engaged in business activities and had connections with Muslims from other countries. We had an Islamic center. We had a mosque, and we were active in the mosque. We organized extensive demonstrations against Salman Rushdie and the chemical bombs that the Germans had provided to Saddam, which killed thousands of Kurds in Halabja and other places. Particularly, we held widespread protests against the parliament, which had provided Saddam with chemical weapons. They took advantage of this entire movement and targeted me as a Muslim who was engaged in religious activities, accusing me falsely.
So, talking about the court now, what was the final court order given to you? And how come you were freed prior to the end of your sentence?
After the trial and the testimony of various witnesses, and after 3 years and 275 court sessions, I was sentenced to life imprisonment, not as an operator, but as an instigator. In fact, they gave me a life sentence and 10 years. But in Germany, there is a law that allows those sentenced to life imprisonment to have a court hearing after 13 years. They reduced my life sentence to 23 years, and after two-thirds of this sentence, I was expelled from Germany, which means I was released from prison after 15 years and 63 days.
Let's talk about, there's been a lot of books that have been written about you and your experience. Let's talk about some of these works.
After my release, journalists asked me many questions, and I told everyone that the sentence imposed on me was illegal. despite Western governments claiming to uphold the rule of law, this government sentenced me, an innocent person, to life imprisonment and put immense pressure on me and my family. It is true that they did not beat me or subject me to physical torture in prison, but they subjected me to psychological torture, which is known as white torture these days. For example, when my family came to visit me, I was not allowed to touch my 7-month-old child. There was a table in the middle of the visiting room, and I was not allowed to kiss or touch my child or hold her in my arms. I have a daughter who is mentally and physically disabled, weighing only 7 or 8 kilograms, and they did not allow me to hold her. This psychological torture never leaves my mind. It would have been much better if they had beaten me. After I came to Iran, I tried to relate those 15 years of memories in a book, which was accomplished by the help of Jose Juanari and the efforts of Mr. Mohsen Kazemi, who took on the task of writing the book. The book, titled Coffee House Painting, was published in 1,000 pages, and a summary of it was published in a book called The Mykonos Phantom. It's been translated into Arabic, and the English translation is also in progress, awaiting publication. All my memories have been included in this book as a response to all journalists and to the world.
Well, let's talk about the war of the embassies. Tell me about that.
When I was in prison, I used to monitor the news. On the day or the day after I was given a life sentence and condemned to death, I don't remember exactly, Germany closed its embassy in Iran and withdrew its ambassador as a protest, because the verdict stated that the Iranian organizations were also involved in the operation. Germany recalled its ambassador, and Iran reciprocally recalled its ambassador to Germany. Then, 16 other European countries, along with Canada and Australia, also closed their embassies and withdrew their ambassadors. The following day, as far as I know, Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader of the revolution, said that since the ambassadors themselves had left Iran, we would also recall our ambassadors. For this reason, all Iranian ambassadors returned from European countries to Iran, and this incident was called the Embassy War. This story continued for about 6 months, and after various negotiations, Iran did not want to send ambassadors to any country again. After a while, first the Greek ambassador returned, Iran also sent back its ambassador to Greece, the other countries returned one by one to Iran, and Iran also sent back its ambassadors. But the interesting point was that Ayatollah Khamenei said, "We don't need the German ambassador now. He can come later." All the ambassadors came except the German ambassador. Later, the French ambassador came to Iran with the German ambassador by plane, but they didn't allow the German ambassador to disembark. They first let the French ambassador disembark, and then the German ambassador entered Iran as the last person. That was the flow of events known as the Embassy War. They went themselves, and they also returned.
Interesting. What about this prisoner exchange? Now, let's talk about this. A prisoner exchange for Helmut Shimkos. Tell me about that part of the story.
There was a German person named Helmut Shimkos. About 6 or 7 years before this incident, he was caught in Berlin, and he was arrested on the Iran-Iraq border. He was spying for Iraq, which he confessed to in his interrogations. He provided information to Saddam about the rockets he was firing at Iran. They arrested him towards the end of the war on the border between Iran and Iraq, and he was tried and confessed. He was given a death sentence. This gentleman, as I mentioned before, had been arrested a few years before Operation Mykonos, and I had no knowledge of his existence at all. 2 or 3 months later, they arrested me. They said that Kazım Darabi is a valuable asset that we can exchange with Helmut Shimkos. During Mr. Rafsanjani's time, negotiations were conducted between Iran and Germany to release Shimkus. And after I spent 10 years in prison, they would release me. Mr. Khatami, during his presidency, when he came to Germany, talked to the German president about this happening. But after 10 years, such a thing did not happen, and Iran released Helmut Shimkus. But the Germans did not release me. They even released two or three other Germans who were also arrested and in prison, but did not release me.
Oh my God, so a few times they were supposed to free you and they didn't. So now that you've been freed, and let's talk about this injustice that took place. Are you planning now to sue the German government?
I have spoken with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Iran, both with Mr. Amir Abdullahian and Mr. Gharib Abadi, who is the Director General of the Islamic Human Rights Organization of Iran, affiliated with the Iranian judiciary. Mr. Gharib Abadi has had three written and oral discussions with the German ambassador in Iran, and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs has also twice requested a meeting with the German ambassador for me to have a visit with my daughter Zainab. However, these inquiries should primarily be pursued through the Islamic Republic of Iran system, and the Iranian judiciary should take action and file a complaint. I have repeatedly stated that there is no evidence proving that I planned or prepared for this operation. This is my court ruling, a 400-page verdict. In the verdict, it is mentioned that I am a Muslim who participates in protests, goes to the mosque, and mourns. So I can depend on the Islamic Republic's system, and I blindly do whatever they want. On page 197 of this verdict, it is stated as follows. After reviewing all the documents and evidence we had, it's been proven that Mr. Kazem Darabi planned this operation. Even the person who confessed to the operation did not know where the weapons came from. But based on our circumstances and evidence, we have concluded that he is guilty. In other words, according to the judge's knowledge, they sentenced me. A judge's knowledge should determine the verdict for a minor offense, not to impose a life imprisonment sentence based on a judge's knowledge. I believe we should file a complaint because both the reputation of the system and my dignity have been lost, and also because I have spent 15 years in prison with 5 years in solitary confinement, and my rights should be restored.
Unbelievable, really. Now, with your daughter, Zainab, who is still in Germany, well, let's talk about during that time, they took her from her mother and gave her to a German family. Did they offer to at least send her to Iran or other members of your family while you were in jail?
Zainab, my daughter, is paralyzed. When I hear her name, I cannot control myself.
I know it's difficult.
Zainab has been sick since birth. She was about 4 years old when I was imprisoned. They would bring her for me to see once every 2 or 3 months. Zainab cannot speak at all. She only says mom and dad. When we talk to her, she understands a little, but she can't respond. If we joke with her, she smiles, but that's the extent of it. She is mentally and physically disabled. During my time in prison, a court session was held, and they sent an expert to our house, to my wife and another one to the prison. They came to assess our living situation, and at that time, we had two other children as well. The court session was held, and the expert stated that since the father of the child was sentenced to life imprisonment, and the mother had two other children and could not take care of the child, they would grant custody of the child to a third person. I got angry and contacted the head of the court, and we had an argument. I even sent my lawyer to the head of the court several times and said, "Fine, provide a caretaker for my child so that her mother can take care of her under supervision. But don't take custody away from me." don't hold my child hostage and give her to a German. After my efforts, it was decided to grant custody not to a gentleman, but to a lady. Sometimes my other children who go to Germany can visit her, but they're not allowed to take her out, for example, to the park and bring her back. They must coordinate with the lady. I believe they do not care about human rights at all. Why? Because they have taken this disabled and paralyzed child hostage and do not allow me and her mother to see her. It's been 18 years since I last saw my child, and her mother has not seen her for 8 years. How can they talk about human rights but not act accordingly? Human rights matter to them only when their own interests are at stake. If the situation were reversed and a German girl was in Iran in a welfare organization and her father was German and the Islamic Republic did not allow her parents to see her, they would condemn Iran and exaggerate the situation in human rights organizations, the United Nations and the European Union. But because my child is sick, they say her life expectancy is 35 to 40 years. I have talked to the German embassy multiple times, requesting that if anything happens to this child and she passes away, at least give me her body.
It's a very, very difficult situation. Mr. Darabi, this is an international station, Press TV, and if your daughter could see this interview, what would you want Zainab to know, if she could understand? What would you want her to know? What message would you give Zainab?
Iranian human rights organizations should follow up and return custody of this child to me, and I should go and bring my child, and her mother and I will take care of her. Where are Western human rights when a father has not been able to see his child for 18 years? Or her mother has not seen her for 8 years. Why? The German rights organization that says if someone spends more than 15 days in solitary confinement, it is considered torture. Where were they when I was in solitary confinement for 5 years? Where is this human rights?
I know that you and your family have gone through a lot, and it's been very difficult. Tell me, what has it been like to be away from Zainab all these years?
For us, being away from Zainab has been very difficult. And it's been years since we have been apart from her. Especially, her mother suffers greatly. I have a 13-year-old daughter as well. And considering that she has only seen Zainab once, she cries and asks me, "When will you bring Zainab?" We think about Zainab every day, and we want her to be with us. If they acknowledge humanity, they should do something to bring this child back to us as soon as possible. Her birthday is on July 9th, when she turns 35.
And we hope and pray that that those who can make this happen will make it happen, and that Zainab will be returned to you and your family. Mr. Kazem Darabadi, thank you so much for talking to us here at Face to Face. Thank you so much for being with us on this very special Face to Face. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
The
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salam alaikum wa rahmatullah. This is Hussein Latifi, and you're listening to the program for humanity from IRIB English Radio. In the following episodes, inshallah, we're going to cover some of the concepts and teachings of the Holy Quran regarding human being and humanity. And I hope, inshallah, that by covering these teachings, we can be prepared for applying them in our lives and getting closer to the perfection and destination that Quran has for us, and also Islam has designated for humanity in large. Now, one thing that I think is important to keep in mind when we discuss the concepts and teachings of the Holy Quran about humanity and mankind is to keep a balanced approach and moderate perspective on these concepts, because some of these concepts are negative, some of them positive, and I've seen people that fall into one side of the discussion, only focusing on the negative discussions, some people focusing only on the positive discussions. But I think it's crucial that we keep a balanced approach and consider all of these teachings together, because there's a reason that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala have listed these concepts or these qualities and traits and descriptions for mankind in his book. Now, if you search the word al-insan in the Holy Quran, approximately, I think, 56 times the word al-insan is used in the Holy Quran. Not to say that the discussions and descriptions of humanity only occur with this reference. No, in other verses, sometimes when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, Ya ayyuhan nas, O people, or when He addresses humanity by the title Ya Bani Adam, the children of Adam, or sometimes even without any direct reference, but we know that He's talking about humanity at large, like when He tells the story of the creation of Adam alayhi salam. So in all of these, when we put them together, we realize that in some of these discussions, human being and mankind has been placed in a very high rank and high position, like the vicegerency of God on earth, beginning of the Holy Quran, like the second chapter of the Holy Quran, when Allah tells the story of the creation of Adam. Famously, you all know that Prophet Adam has been placed in the position that is unmatched, and no one else in the whole creation has that position, and that is the vicegerency of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala on earth, which is very important, and it raised the astonishment of the angels, and you all know the story. And also other verses that praise mankind, like وَلَقَدْ كَرَّمْنَا بَنِي آدَمْ, and other verses that talk about some specific things that only mankind was capable of doing, like the verse of Amana, that Inna aradna al-amana, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, we exposed or we offered Amana to the whole creation, and nobody accepted that, but man accepted that Amana to be the one carrying out that Amana, and that is a unique thing for humanity. But again, as I said, if you search the word al-insan, almost all cases that insan is mentioned in the Holy Quran, you find it associated with some sort of negative description, like خُلِقَ الْإِنسَانَ عَجُولًا or كَفُورًا or something like that, or مِنْ عَجَلْ, or many things that hint to some negative sides about this being. And we should see why is that, why these negative traits and qualities have been counted for insan. Inshallah, after the break, we come back and we discuss about the wisdom and philosophy behind those negative descriptions.
Dear listeners, you're listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Okay, welcome back. This is Hossein Latifi. You're listening to For Humanity program from IRIB English Radio. We were talking about the qualities and descriptions of mankind and al-insan in the Holy Quran. And I said, when you search the word al-insan in the Holy Quran, you encounter many negative descriptions and qualities. And we were trying to know the reason behind this. I know some of these descriptions come heavy for some people. In fact, the Holy Quran itself could be encountered in this way as a heavy word, and it describes itself. Quran describes itself as a heavy word. نَحْنُ نَزَلْنَا عَلَيْكَ قَوْلًا or إِنَّا نَزَلْنَا عَلَيْكَ قَوْلًا ثَقِيلًا. We have ascended down to you, descended down to you a heavy word. So part of this heaviness is the seriousness and directness and frankness of the Holy Quran when it comes to the description of humanity and human beings. And we should not get emotional. Some people get emotional and they think that it's a matter of, like, for example, suppressing humanity or something like that. But it's not the case. It's a reality that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants, by bringing up those things, those negative qualities and descriptions, somehow inform us about the realities that we have to face when we deal with different situations, to know our capacities, to know our qualities, and to be careful not to fall down into the pitfalls in the journey that we have as a human being. So some people, as I said, they get emotional when they hear about those positive descriptions. Some they get emotional when they hear about those negative descriptions. And they end up being in emotional swings. Like either it's all good and nothing is problematic, as if nothing is wrong with me and I'm all happy, or I'm completely depressed and there is no possibility to talk about anything with me. So this is not the correct way to understand the approach of Quran in defining us for ourselves. Quran tries to tell us, okay, these are your possibilities, that the vicegerency of God on earth and the position that is upper than even angels, and also these are the pitfalls of being a human, and you should be careful about that. Nothing is emotional, nothing is bad in this. This is actually good that we encounter this in reality and accept the truth about ourselves and think about the best possible way to come up with some solutions and some way out from those problems and difficulties associated with being a human per se. So inshallah, in the coming episodes, we try to find out that, okay, now that we have a full description of human soul, that it has these possibilities, these virtues, these highest standards, and then at the same time it had these shortcomings, these pitfalls, these problems. So what is the plan that Quran puts ahead and puts before us in order to achieve the perfection that Quran has for human being? This is very important because that plan is based on the capabilities and possibilities that we have as human beings. By considering different dimensions and aspects of the discussion, and also different stages that Quran has for that plan, for perfection, for humanity, I think we can at least know the prospect and the general outlook of what it looks like, a human being according to Quranic teachings. And then when we want to apply them, we can be more familiar with these concepts. Thank you very much. Walhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen. صلى الله على محمد صلى الله على النبي صلى الله على محمد وعلى آل النبي.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
President Raisi says Iranians will not give in to U.S. sanctions, adding that Washington's so-called maximum pressure campaign against Tehran has failed. Iraq is pledging not to allow any threat from its Kurdistan region to Iran after announcing relocation of Kurdish armed groups away from joint borders.